behavioral scientist, teaching and learning, at the edge of my field, and a dad.
And a dad, yeah.
And a dad. What I would say, however, is the way that we measure advertising is typically wrong, right? So typically what we do is measure sentiment, right? Did this advertisement change belief or sentiment? But we don't actually understand the connection between sentiment and behavior, right? And so as a consequence, advertisers, the people who create advertising, ad agencies, creative agencies, et cetera, are not held accountable for the right thing. They're not actually held accountable for driving behavior. They're held accountable for, you know, sort of perception shift. And the problem is that perception shift, A, it's notoriously hard to measure. B, it can be very temporary. You know, I do a lot of work on gender equity in the world. And one of the things we talk about, when you look at men who act in ethical, equitable ways, they often have a gender confidant, meaning they have women who are close to them and empowered to say things to them, right?
What is your greatest joy?
Bear, my son.
Hello, fellows. Welcome to the next episode of Jagged with Jastravi, Conversations at the Edge with thought leaders from the marketing, branding, and the business world. And today we have Matt with us. Hi, Matt. It's so nice to have you on the show.
Hi, nice to have. Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to read a line from your book, which I felt very happy to read. To know that if this is the case, okay, I feel included. So humans are born behavioral scientists. From our very first cry, we begin to shape what others do by exerting pressure, ball, and they feed us, coo, and they snuggle us. Isn't that amazing perspective? You know, when you say this, it makes so much sense. But professionally speaking, when you say that everyone can be a behavioral scientist, what do you mean by that?
For some people, when we say behavioral science, I think what they conjure up is where there's psychology and these sciences that happen in a lab. And applied behavioral science is about taking these things that happen in a lab and applying them in the world. And that is not what I mean, right? When I say behavioral science, I mean behavior as an outcome, science as a process, right? And so when you look at it that way, everyone is capable of doing that, right? As I sort of, as you mentioned in that quote, right? Humans create behavior in other humans all the time, right? We do it naturally. We do it long before we can articulate anything. What we're really adding here is the scientific method, which to me is the most beautiful thing humans have ever created. The most beautiful things we ever created was the scientific process, the ability to observe the world around us, draw hypotheses from those observations, and then to test those hypotheses using experimentation. That process, to me, is gorgeous. And so when I talk about everyone can be a behavioral scientist, you can be the janitor, right? And you can say, I noticed that, like, you know, if I move the trash can here, it seems like people, you know, throw things away more. So I'll, you know, experiment with where I put the trash cans, right? Like, all of those are things, like, anyone can do that process, as long as we understand the scientific method, right? The basics of, you know, how to test something and then draw a conclusion from it, then I think we all have the capability of doing that. So for me, behavior is an outcome, science is a process. And what that unlocks is all of us having the ability to do science.
Awesome. So, Matt, you say that it's a verb. Don't look at it as a noun. It's an action, and you can try. You can be a beginner, but or perhaps you're already doing it, and you can, you know, figure out a process to it, a better process to it. You can be better at it, but you're doing it instinctively. You're doing it, right? So now, if using any case study, you could tell us what are the levers of understanding this process of causing behavior change, because I love when you say that behavior change should be the focus of everything that you do. And we'd go down to a lot of, phenomenons where historically it's not considered as the focus. which you've mentioned in your book also. So if you could use a case study to any few aspects, this intervention design process, for example, or a behavioral statement, any levers if you could elaborate on.
Yeah, for sure. So if we take this top level and we say, okay, behavioral science, behavior is an outcome, science is a process. If we go one level down from that, right, the analogy that works best for understanding it is science fiction, right? All of us are trying to create worlds that do not exist, right? If we were okay with the status quo, we wouldn't have to do anything. You and I wouldn't be doing this podcast, right? Like, you wouldn't be recording this. You wouldn't be putting things into this format if you weren't trying to create a world that was different than the one that we have, mm-hmm. right? And so if you think then about science fiction, it can kind of guide you through the process we want to go through. Because what's the first thing you have to do? Well, you have to articulate the world you want, right? Here's what it looks like when we get it right. Here's the world I want to live in, right? And so we talk about this as behavioral strategy. How do you define the outcome that you want? And this is not a scientific process, right? This is an opinionated process. Hmm. Like, the world you want may be different than the world I want, maybe different than the world that Google wants or Microsoft wants or some different company wants. But it is important to articulate, what does it look like when we get it right? And not, to your point, like, well, it has an app. No. As an outcome, what is happening? What are people physically, literally doing? Can I close my eyes and in a rich way envision this world? Mm-hmm. So that's behavioral strategy. Once we've done that, well, we need to say, all right, where are we now, right? I can't get to here if I don't know where I am, mm-hmm. right? And so that's the observational part of science, right? When we talk about science, there's two sciences, observational science and experimental science, right? So we first have to start with observational science. And what we really want to do is we want to say two things. One, why would anyone want to live in this other world, right? Given that we have a world and there's another world that we want, why would anyone want to live there? And given that people want to live there, why aren't we already living there? Why aren't we already in that place, right? Now, broadly in behavioral science, we talk about those as promoting pressures, you know, things that make people want this alternative future or make that alternative future more likely, and inhibiting pressures, things that make that alternative future less likely, right? So what we're really trying to do in this observational piece, this what we call behavioral insights, is trying to observe the world we have to understand that balance of pressures. And what we're really trying to do is we're trying to look at five kinds of people. Because everybody in the world, with respect to any particular behavior, falls into the always, never, sometimes, started, stopped. Let's actually use your show as an example, right? Mm-hmm. So there are people who always listen, mm-hmm. never listen, sometimes listen, used to listen but stopped, or didn't used to listen but started. Right? Everybody in the world falls into one of those five categories. And if we can go observe what's different about those categories, it can teach us things about how we might need to rebalance the pressures. So as an example, let's take the always and the never. Mm-hmm. Maybe the difference between the always and the never is that always is just likes podcasts in general, right? In general, thinks podcasts are more valuable than the nevers do, right? So the always, that's the difference. It's a difference in promoting pressure. But equally likely is it could be a difference in time. Maybe the always people have more time on their hands than the never people do, right? The never people are more busy, right? Mm-hmm. And discovering that difference is what takes us into the next phase, right? Behavioral design. Because if we have a world we want and we have a world that we have already, we need to build a bridge in between them, right? We need to build something, some sort of intervention that moves the two worlds closer together. But the intervention that you would build varies greatly depending on what we saw from those pressures, right? So for example, if the difference between the always and the never was that the always were more convinced that this show is awesome than the nevers were, well, hey, we might want to, you know, have an intervention that's about convincing people that the show is really awesome, right? We might need additional media or clips or advertising or other kinds of promoting pressure things, right? That made them see, this show is really awesome. Right. But if what we found, for example, is that, hey, the dominant difference between the always and the never is that the never people just, you know, don't have time to sit down and listen to a huge episode. Well, hey, maybe we need to make episodes shorter or break them down into chapters or, you know, re-edit them into smaller things. Those are really different interventions. Go run ads versus shorten the format are really different interventions that come from really different understandings of the pressures. Right. Mm-hmm. So now we've gone through strategy. We know the world we want. Right? We've observed the world we have, and we've started to say, okay, here's how we build a bridge. But we're not done, right? Because remember, this is science. And so the bridge doesn't work just because we believe it will work. It works because we push people out onto the bridge and we see if they walk across. That's experimentation, right? That's that fourth step. right? Mm-hmm. Impact evaluation, or, you know, that experimental science piece where we say, hey, I'm not going to change the format of my show all up, but I'll take some old episodes and I'll make some shorter clips and I'll see if that changes listening behavior, mm-hmm. right? I'm not going to spend $100,000 on advertising, but hey, I'll spend $100 and just see, hey, what is the return on that? Does that really make a difference? What is the small light version that we can do that validates the concept and shows us either, yeah, we're in the right direction, or no, we're really not. So those are the four stages, right? Strategy, which tells us where we want to go. Insights, which tells us where we are. Design, which tries to build a bridge in between. And then impact evaluation, where we say, all right, let's put people on that bridge.
So, Matt, now I'm very tempted to skip to straight to qualitative.
Anywhere you want to go. This is your show. Yeah. You can talk about anything you want.
Thank you. So, you know, market research, for example. Now, typically behavioral science, I mean, there is a whole understanding that you're going to understand the why, you will keep the context as the most important thing. And qualitative researchers, you know, sometimes say that this is just a term. We've already been doing this, you know, when we conduct an ethnography, you know, we know everything about the context that one can know, you know, as an observer, right? We are only focused on why. We exist because the why needs to be known, you know, things like that. So I know you make this distinction between applied and theoretical behavioral science also, but what would your, if this is a verb, you know, behavioral science, how can researchers incorporate this into their day-to-day work, even quant researchers?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think that there's a couple of things going on there. And certainly, you know, so these days I'm the head of behavioral science at Frog, right, design. And sometimes when, you know, Frog goes into a client who's asked us to take a look at what they're doing, you know, we'll have a research team that's in there that's like, hey, why do we have to do new research? We really know everything we need to know. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes the research is really great. One of the pitfalls I sometimes see is, you know, when you talk about ethnographic research, you're often taking a lens of demographics, right? Whether it's socioeconomic status or gender or whatever, right? You start from those places of difference and then try and say, well, there are different reasons and motivations for why people go through things. Mm-hmm. To me, this seems a little bit backwards, right? I think we want to start with the segmentation of behavior, and then maybe gender emerges. So maybe the difference between the always and the never is that there's a lot more women in one category than in the other category. Okay, cool. That might tell us something, right? Like, it's not that gender isn't a factor, but it only matters because it drives a behavior, right? We shouldn't a priori decide it matters. We should decide it matters because it emerges naturally from our understanding of the behavioral difference, right? Mm-hmm. I do think qual and quant working together is really important. I think in a lot of businesses, I see them still very, very separate, right? Design research or user research is over here somewhere, right? Quant or analytics is over there somewhere. You know, they have different leaders. They're not incentivized to work together. And that to me seems really foolhardy because, you know, what you want is this constant back and forth. When you see me run it, you know, the typical behavioral science project that I run is between 12 and 14 weeks, right? It's pretty short. Mm-hmm. And I've just found over 20 years of experience that that's the sort of, that shortness provides us the focus that we need. But what that means is that, you know, our quant and quals are talking on a daily basis, right? Quant is saying, I looked in the data, here are the things I saw in the data today. Can you go see if you can hear them in users, right? And qual is saying, all right, like, here's what we heard in the users we talked to today. Like, can you see if that's true in the data? And so they're constantly cross-validating each other, mm-hmm. right? To your point, if you think of market research as arriving at the truth, right? That's our job. Our job is to figure out what is the underlying truth. You can think of the truth as a table. And if, you know, a table with one leg falls over, right? You need multiple legs. You need multiple perspectives to hold up that truth. And you need them to be as far apart as you can, right? Taking a bunch of different quant studies is like making a table with legs at one corner, right? You can keep adding legs, but they, you know, they're of diminishing marginal value because they don't provide, you know, strong contrast. Mm-hmm. What I want is to take really different methodologies and use that to hold things up. But I think you can, broadly, research occurs at every phase of what we do. Right? Mm-hmm. There's research that figures out what behaviors we need to do in the first place, right? That fits into that strategy bucket, right? What behaviors are interesting mm-hmm. and at what level? Mm-hmm. you know, I was the chief behavioral officer at Clover Health, an insurance company. And one of the things that was most interesting to me is, you know, I worked with a bunch of actuaries to figure out, you know, how much did we save in medical expense and make in revenue? Because you get a bonus when this happens every time we get a flu shot. So every time we get someone at Clover a flu shot, how much do you think we make? Mm-hmm. And when I went to our executives, the average estimate was about 10 bucks. People were like, yeah, flu shot's probably worth about 10 bucks in terms of saved medical expense. Keeps people from going to the hospital, right? They don't get the flu, et cetera. The real answer is 100 bucks, right? It was almost 10x different than people who had a lot of experience in healthcare would have predicted, mm-hmm. right? And so I think research can occur at any phase, and because there's a huge difference between the intervention we make for $10 and the intervention we can spend $100 on, right? Those are really different interventions in an applied way. And so I think, you know, you can see research at any phase. I think you want quant and qual together. I think they need to be going back and forth quickly. And I think that you want to start with behavior, not with demographics or ethnographic, but rather with what are the behaviors that I care about, and then let those demographics and ethnographics emerge from that.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Okay, so exhausted. Thank you for summing up that also.
I'm trying to be very complete in my answers.
Yeah. I always sum up at the end. Yeah, yeah. Great. So now we move to, you know, market research. And now we talk about advertising, because advertising somehow, I mean, very happily, everybody agrees that, you know, I mean, you can focus on perception change, you can focus on belief change, and one half of advertising is going to go waste, but it's okay, it's long term, it's just going to be a little nudge in that direction, and we should be fine with that. So I mean, we'll figure out what we want to measure, and that can be a very small thing. And as long as we are meeting that, you know, we can keep doing it. So you've also mentioned that in your book that, you know, 1% of US GDP is spent to compensate for the fact that behavior change is not the central aim of advertising. Now, what I want to know is, so how, if you as a behavioral scientist had to reimagine advertising, what would that be? That's one. B, this assumption that perception change or a belief change is going to lead to behavior change, you know, is that correct? Because the opposite also is very correct. And especially if we see in our life, you know, sometimes we actually change behavior, and over a period of time, our belief and attitude changes, or we make realizations. So, yeah. Over to you.
Yeah. So on the first one, how would I reimagine advertising? Well, let's say two things. First of all, One, I think, and I'm by no means an advertising theorist, so I'm sure there are other ways to break this up. But one of the ways that I break up advertising in my mind is advertising that makes me aware of something that didn't exist versus something that tries to convince me that something is worth using, right? And a lot of times the former is sufficient. There are lots and lots of things in the world that would make my life better, but I just don't know about them, right? Entertainment is a really great example of this, right? Like, there are lots of shows I would love to watch if I knew that they existed, but I didn't know that they existed, so how would I have known to watch them, right? Which is why recommendations are such an important part of human culture, right? It's one of the ways that we socialize, right? Mm-hmm. You know, let's say Bollywood's a great example, right? I don't know anything about Bollywood. I'm sure in the panoply of Bollywood movies are things I would love to watch, movies I would really enjoy. But because I don't know anything about them, there's no opportunity for me to engage in that. And so I think that same thing occurs in advertising. There are informational advertisements that are about helping me understand that a thing exists, right? Then there are motivational advertisements. Nobody in the world doesn't know that Coke exists, right? Like, we are all very aware that there is a soft drink and it is called Coca-Cola. That there's a soft drink that exists and it is called Coca-Cola, right? And so instead, Coke is running advertisements that are about convincing me to drink Coke, right? Trying to strengthen their brand position. And that's the place where I can understand it. There's nothing wrong with it, right? In the sense that it is one lever for creating change, but it is a lever that we over rely on in terms of how much, you know, we sort of spend. If you look at, for example, Mars, right, when they advertise M&Ms, yet it's still not particularly easy for me to get M&Ms. I have to go somewhere to get them. They don't just magically appear in my house. I don't live in a world where there are M&Ms constantly around me, right? If they took even a portion of their ad budget and just said, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make M&Ms really available. That would be really impactful. You and I and everybody else has a bias, which is when I say, hey, just to be like, let's go get people to eat more M&Ms. We automatically gravitate towards promoting pressures. Let's introduce new flavors. Let's run advertisements. Let's do those things, right? We systematically ignore inhibiting pressures and vice versa, right? If I said, all right, get people to stop smoking, we automatically gravitate towards inhibiting pressures, right? We focus on all the things, you know, we put laws and taxes and blah, 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 right? But we don't think about like, well, let's ban advertising. Let's get rid of promoting pressures. Mm-hmm. And so this tendency to move towards advertising, because most of the time we're trying to get people to do something more. That's the job of most capitalist organizations, is to get people to do something more, usually buy something more. This reliance on advertising is part of our overall reliance on promoting pressures. And we just need to redirect some of that towards inhibiting pressures and vice versa in things like public health, et cetera, where we need to get people to stop doing things. You know, we typically over rely on these inhibiting pressures. We're going to make it harder to do illegal, you know, systematic change on this side. And we don't do much about the like, well, hey, you know, it doesn't do much good to put in place new laws when you're continuing to allow McDonald's to like advertise every day, all day, in every sector.
And everywhere, yeah. Hmm. Okay.
So our reliance on advertising is a part of a larger bias that we have to get past, right? We have to look at those other sets of pressures that we typically ignore.
Mm-hmm. And to part B, Matt, a behavior is an action, right? Something. So advertising, when it is focusing on sometimes just as a promotional pressure on just encouraging a motivation or leading you to recognize something, a need that, you know, is not very salient in your mind, or, you know, there, would you say that's the correct focus?
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with trying to create a promoting pressure through advertising, right? Mm-hmm. Motivation, belief is a very powerful motivation. Mm-hmm. Probably the most powerful pressure on either side is identity, right? Like, yeah. How we conceive of ourselves and whether an action is congruent with that self-conception is actually a huge, huge part of what we do. So I do think that, like, you know, I'm not by any means saying advertising doesn't work. What I would say, however, is that the way that we measure advertising is typically wrong, right? So typically what we do is measure sentiment, right? Did this advertisement change belief or sentiment? But we don't actually understand the connection between sentiment and behavior, right? And so as a consequence, advertisers, the people who create advertising, ad agencies, creative agencies, et cetera, are not held accountable for the right thing. They're not actually held accountable for driving behavior. They're held accountable for, you know, sort of perception shift. And the problem is that perception shift, A, it's notoriously hard to measure. B, it can be very temporary. And so, you know, I think if you're looking to somebody to create advertising and you're holding them accountable for the right thing, right? You're holding them accountable ultimately for the behavior that they drive, that's less bad. But I think there's a lot of intermediate measures, you know. And this happens not just in advertising, this happens in lots of things. I think that like NPS, like I hate NPS. Right. For those that don't know, NPS is Net Promoter Score. And basically you ask people, how likely would they be to recommend your service or product to somebody else? And then, you know, you take scored on 1 to 10 and you take the, you know, I can't ever remember what it actually is, but it's the, you know, take the
loyalty levels, huh?
Yeah. You take the nines and the tens, and then you minus the 1 through 5s or something, you know, there's some math formula. And then you come out with a score, and this score is like the thing that companies hold themselves accountable for. They talk about their NPS in their like stock reports, and you know, they're compared between companies and blah, 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 blah. What a stupid measure, right? Like, what a stupid measure. It's not a measure of whether people actually did recommend anything. It's just, would you recommend something 1 to 10, right? It's not, you know, if you look at the research, it's not very predictive of behavior. You know, there are lots and lots of things that I feel generally good about, but I don't know that I'd necessarily recommend to other people, right? Mm. Simply because they just don't, like, how likely are you to recommend toothpaste?
Mm.
Like, that's just not, it's just not a thing that would ever come up in conversation.
In a conversation, yeah.
Right? Whereas, like, I don't know, recommending the show I just watched, I recommend, you know, media, mm. entertainment things all the time, right? There are, yeah. like, weird biases. It's a terrible measure, right? Yeah. Measure behavior. At the end of the day, measure behavior, because behavior is the thing that matters.
Yeah. And so wonderful, because today you have that kind of data also available. You know, till some time back, you never could access the behavior at each throughout the consumer journey. But today you have heaps and heaps of data. So if it gets the importance it deserves, makes everybody's life simpler and more effective and efficient, perhaps marketing budgets at least. Okay. So,
yeah. I mean, yeah. Hold on. Let's talk about that, right? I think that data piece is actually really important. It's there used to be this conference that I loved called Data Gotham. It was organized by Hillary Mason and some other folks. Hillary, of course, has had a brilliant career as a prominent data scientist. And it was one of those conferences that, like, you would only really go if you were really, really into data, right? It was a very geeky conference, right? Okay. There are lots of data conferences where, you know, there's lots of people across a whole spectrum of people of skill levels that are coming, right, mm-hmm. to learn about data. This was really like, you have to be fairly geeky. And I remember talking to Hillary, who's a friend at one of these conferences, and sort of marveling at the fact that at the time, many people referred to both of us as data scientists, but we did nothing that looked even remotely similar, right? Like, we just didn't, like, behavioral science at the time was thought of very close to data science. And I'm like, I don't know, man, this doesn't really seem doing a lot of the same things day to day. But it's nice. It's been nice to see data science come into its own, right? Over the last 20-ish or so years of my career, right? You know, we went from a place 20 years ago where, you know, there were very few job postings for a data scientist. If there were, you didn't really know what to ask for, mm-hmm. right? Sort of like behavioral science now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, my hope is that over time, behavioral science kind of catches up to data science, right? In the same way, I and other behavioral sciences leaders typically often talk about the way that, like, you know, using the way that data science prolificated as a blueprint for how behavioral science will prolificate.
I want to know a little bit about more about what is an intervention. Because, you know, typically, so would something non-tangible, could that also be an intervention? Like you said, motivation, like a belief formation or something. Like, for example, a story that inspires.
Stories.
Meditation in the morning, you know.
But stories are tangible.
Stories are tangible?
Stories are tangible. Of course they're tangible, right? Like, the very fact that you and I can both discuss a Disney movie and recite roughly the same plot tells me that the story is tangible. It's a durable good that can be communicated between people. It's absolutely tangible, right? Just because I could write it, like, the moment I, you know, if we use, like, the most extreme version of tangible, the moment I write it down, it becomes tangible. But
yes.
The very fact that I could write it down is the fact that, you know, that I didn't write it down doesn't make it somehow less tangible.
Right.
So
the inspiration or what I take out of that story, for example, you know, I mean, and that's an intangible. And that impacts my behavior. I mean, okay, we are stretching the logic, but...
Well, no. I don't know what you're stretching. I think you're good. So
okay.
Let's take the Disney movie as the intervention, right? The story of a Disney movie as the intervention. Right. What I think people typically stumble across is they think that an intervention changes behavior directly. Right. So, like, intervention, behavior change. And really, there's a mediated step, which is the intervention changes some pressure, and that pressure creates new behavior. Right. Because that encompasses the thing that you just said, which is that, hey, you and I might watch the same Disney movie and have very different reactions. Yes, you're absolutely right. Right. It's absolutely true that we could, a similar intervention operating across different people might create different behavioral results. Let's say the behavior is recommending the Disney movie, right? I might watch it, you know, it touches something, you know, it interacts with my personality or whatever, creates promoting pressure that causes me to recommend it to others. It doesn't do that for you, right? And thus you don't recommend it to others, right? So it's not true movie equals recommendation. It's movie something, some pressure. Right. Intervention. And one of the things that I think is buried in what you're saying is it's key to understand this is a probabilistic science, not a deterministic science. So what do I mean by that? right? If you wanted to change Matt's behavior, specifically Matt's behavior, you would probably do something like therapy, right? It's very individualistic. It's very customized, right? It's really about changing like literally that guy's behavior, right? That person right there, specific person. Mm-hmm. But that's not what behavioral science is. We're a probabilistic behavior. So we're saying across 100 mats, there are 50 of them do this today, and I'm going to get 80 of them to do it, mm-hmm. right? It's not literally every single mat right there, that specific mat, right? Not, there's 100% chance that that specific mat does it, but rather mm-hmm. that across a larger group, mm-hmm. it's more likely that this thing will occur. So if we think about our Disney movie, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to create a Disney movie where literally everyone loves it, right? What I'm trying to do is increase the probability that someone will love it and thus recommend it, mm-hmm. right? That there, that I will increase this promoting pressure that mm-hmm. is motivation, whatever, mm-hmm. and that will create recommendation probabilistically, right? Not specifically Matt will do it. I think we would do different things in the world if we were trying to get specifically one person and one person alone to do a thing.
Yeah, yeah. And that is why, like you were saying, design and test and... So that entire intervention works to the best possible potential in
that's right.
impact across those 100 people. Yeah,
that's right. Across those larger groups of people. Right. So we might start. And this is the difference between, you know, you talked earlier about I make the distinction frequently between applied and academic science. Mm-hmm. Right. Academic science is trying to determine the degree to which something is true. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they need to run much larger tests, right? Larger groups of people, higher degrees of statistical certainty, et cetera. Mm. Applied behavioral science, I don't have to care about any of that. I just have to be right enough. So here's one of my favorite examples, all right? What if I said, hey, if you and I snap our fingers together on the count of three, right, we're going to cure all known forms of cancer, you and me together right now. Okay, ready? One, two, three, snap. All right, so... did that work? Probably not, right? But the effort was so low that it was worth doing anyway because the effort was so low, right? If snapping once a day had a 1% chance of curing cancer, I'd snap every day, right? And it doesn't matter if that's P less than 0.05 or what the effect size is because outcome is so high, so important, and the effort is so low, it's worth doing. And that's really what applied behavioral science is. It is adding notions of value, right? Outcome, right? Impact of outcome, how important an outcome is, and effort, right? So if you take academic science and you say, okay, we're going to take these truths, but we're going to add, well, how important of a truth is it, right? How much does it lead to something I care about? And how hard is it to use? That's really applied behavioral science. And so, you know, this can be a struggle for lots of academics. You know, if you think about the statistics portion of it, Quick lesson in statistics for those who are listening, right? The typical in psychology, the typical measure for something being true is P less than 0.05. What does P less than 0.05 mean? It means that there is a 19 in 20 chance that the thing that we have observed is real, right? So if we observe a difference, there's a 95% chance that difference is real and a 5% chance that difference is not real. So that's the standard measure for things, right? And so frequently when a data scientist comes and, you know, I interview them for joining my team, I'll ask them, hey, I have an intervention that is P.2, right? So remember, that's four times higher, right? Four times worse than the academic bar. And so most of them would say we should do nothing, right? Like there's a 4 in 10 chance, right? Or a 2 in 5 chance. Right? There's a 40% chance that what you're observing is not real. I say, well, why didn't you ever ask me about what it is? Let me tell you what it is. It's a little pill, costs 1 penny to manufacture. It melts on your tongue, right? Tastes of unicorns and rainbow farts and like, you know, like cures all known forms of cancer, has no known side effects. And there's a 60% chance that it does that. I think maybe we should keep going, maybe run another pilot, see if we can get that. Like, you don't just abandon something because it's P.4. You keep going, you iterate, right? That's that applied piece. It's that piece of going that extra step and saying like, hey, I'm going to modulate my response here based on how hard it is to do. Remember, it costs only a penny to manufacture and has no known side effects, right? And how big the outcome is. It cures all known forms of cancer. All right, well, maybe I'm going to keep running on that.
I do somehow feel that, you know, behavioral science, and I'm no, I am a layperson when it comes to behavioral science, right? That there is a reason why it's suddenly becoming so important. Is it saying anything about how we are evolving as a society?
Well, it is a fundamentally optimistic science, right? There's probably somebody who would argue with, maybe Steve Wendell or somebody would argue with me about this, I don't know. But to me, it's a fundamental, it is fundamentally an optimistic science, right? Because it says we believe human behavior can change. What we are, so various social psychologists have argued that the most important finding in psychology is the fundamental attribution error, right? Fundamental attribution error. Or put differently, the tendency to subscribe people's behavior to something about them rather than something in their environment. This is an error, first of all, right? We know that many people's behavior is guided by their environment much more than it is their individual personality, right? I love the Shakespeare quote, "My need but not my will consents," right? Like, he's motivated by poverty, not by his own internal moral compass. He's poor, and so he's going to sell this poison because he's poor, not because of his own internal compass, right? You know, making certain choices is a luxury, right, of those with privilege. And I think we have to be very conscious of that.
Yeah.
if we believe, right, that humans fundamentally overpredict the degree to which something is about a person, what behavioral science says is, hey, I embrace it's often about people's environment and that those environments can be changed. And to me, that's a fundamentally optimistic science, right? It says, I don't just have to accept the status quo. There's a certain number of shitty people in the world who just are bad, and there's nothing I can do about it. Instead, it says, no, people are shaped by their environment and I can do something about it. Now, we know that people also come into the world with personalities, right? When my son was born, he was not a blank slate. He had his own set of personality. You know, he's an extrovert and he's, you know, he's lovely and wonderful and wild and crazy and all of these things. You know, he had a personality. But that doesn't determine everything that he will do in his life. He's still guided by, you know, I and my co-parent and the world that surrounds him and the world he lives in and all those things. And so to me, it's a fundamentally optimistic science because it says, hey, we can change people's behavior. Because if you don't believe people's change behavior can change, why would you ever do behavioral science? Right? If you don't believe, if you believe people are destined to do the same thing that they've always done, right, and always will do, then there's no point in engaging with behavioral science.
The life itself becomes pointless. It's like you came with a certain, you know, like a program. I mean, oh God, I hope I'm not talking about Matrix, but you just came like programmed and you'll just live like that. You're a puppet then, and there is no point in. So I get it. Oh, this is beautiful. This is
my favorite. My favorite example of this in the US is credit scores, right?
Sorry?
So credit scores. So in the US, we, you know, we look at your past bill paying behavior and debt paying behavior and all those other kinds of things, and we give you a score. And that determines, you know, what kind of loan you'll get in the future and whether you can get a mortgage and all these things. Right. But what that fundamentally assumes is that you will, in fact, never change. I got in like a knockdown, drag out fight with the head of risk at American Express once about like whether people's credit scores like were reflective of their future behavior or not. And if you just believe, you know, people come out of the womb with a credit score stamped on their butt, right? Like, and that's their credit worthiness, and it's always going to be their credit worthiness, and it's always been their credit worthiness. Then you're right. You should not pay any attention to me whatsoever. But I think you are fundamentally wrong.
And also then it's like past is going to decide the future always. Then there is going to be no evolution, no progress. If it's always the past behavior, no. That is why I guess, you know, I'm going to back to that paragraph of your introduction where you said that, you know, we can change the world. I want nothing lesser than that. It is amazing. Okay. And then what about the ethics of it, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, so we could do a whole separate podcast on the ethics. It's very long.
Okay, for this one, just a small answer, just for this question.
There's a lot going on there. I think, you know, one version of this is don't be an asshole. And you know, it sounds sort of trite, but it actually is remarkably, like, human beings are pretty good at knowing when we do, when things are really bad ideas. And not necessarily internally, we don't necessarily always have a good internal compass, but we can use behavioral tests to tell us, right? Like, mm-hmm. hey, if you wouldn't want something to be public, probably it's a bad idea, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't want any, you know, if you're compelled to keep something a secret, there might be some moral implications of the thing that you are doing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, that's not always true. There are lots of cases where, you know, the public lynch mob can be a bad guide for behavior. But if you wouldn't want to tell people you love, that mm-hmm. might be a bad mm-hmm. idea. Mm-hmm. So the thing I'll say about ethics is the first and most important step is to pay attention to them, right? Everything beyond that, you'll figure out, right? You can go read my book, you can go read other books, like you can look at what other people are doing, you can set up an ethical review board, right? Like, you know, there are very simple things to do. But the first thing you have to do is even believe that it's a thing that anybody should care about, right? So if you can implement, you know, step one, implement an ethical check, right? Before you do anything, just stop. Stop. Right? Human beings have this problem with momentum, right? I have this problem. When we get on a roll, we're just on a roll. And it's just like that momentum keeps us going. And so that momentum will tend to carry us, you know, if you think of ethics, you know, as an inhibiting pressure, a reason not to do something, that sort of momentum that we have overcomes those ethical considerations. So the first and most important thing that you have to do is stop. Come to a complete and full stop. Take a breath. Mm-hmm. Take a moment. And decide, hey, like, what's really going on here? Am I willing to restart? Because if an idea is good, you should be willing to start walking again from a full stop, right? If the only thing can carrying an idea along is momentum. Probably not a very good idea, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Step one is stop. Mm-hmm. If you want to go a second step, it's tell someone else, right? It's tell someone else. You know, challenges thrive in the dark. So if we stop and we talk to someone, those are probably the two key most important things that you can do to prevent, you know, unethical behavior. Stop and talk.
Awesome. So the transparency of it and behavioral checks as external checks. Mm-hmm. And like you said, from people you love, because, you know, they're because the crowds can go wrong, but yeah.
A great example of this actually is, you know, I do a lot of work on gender equity in the world. Mm. And one of the things we talk about when you look at men who act in ethical, equitable ways, they often have a gender confidant, meaning they have women who are close to them and empowered to say things to them, right? Mm. The thing I always say is somebody can't be your, if they can't literally call bullshit, right? If they're not in a position with you where they can say the word bullshit to you and have that be okay, then you haven't sufficiently empowered them to be a good ethical check, right? If they're not allowed to curse at you, like that's probably a sign that they're like not set up well to be a good ethical partner for you. Mm-hmm. And so having those sort of confidant people who are empowered, specifically empowered mm-hmm. to tell us, hey, you're fucking this one up. That's key. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay. This is the like laser round.
This is rapid fire. We took it literally. Yes. What's something new happening in your life right now?
COVID.
Okay. If you could live anywhere in the world, where would that be?
Philippines.
Okay. If you had to, what would you change about yourself?
Everything? I don't know. I would like to be less angry.
Okay. What is your favorite childhood memory?
Ooh. When I was very, very young, I must have been like maybe 3 or 4 years old. My dad woke me up on like a Sunday. It was a beautiful like spring kind of morning. And he woke me up because a spider, really big, giant fucking spider, had made this beautiful web in the rock wall in the backyard. And there was like dew on it and the sun was shining through the dew. So it was this beautiful spider web with a beautiful spider, the sun shining through. And so my dad woke me up so that I could see it before all the dew dried.
If you were to devote the rest of your life to philanthropy, what cause would you choose?
Gender equity.
Okay. What is your deepest fear?
I'm not telling you that.
What is
that can be used against me.
Okay. What is your greatest joy?
Bear, my son.
Okay. How would you like strangers to remember you?
Not at all.
Okay. What is a lesson that took you a long time to learn?
That sometimes pulling less hard is more productive.
Okay, nice. What is one missed opportunity that you wish you could have a second chance at?
When I was like 15 years old and getting my first car, we lived in this place that is an electric co-op, which is really weird. And they were auctioning off one of the like cars from the, like a, it was like an SUV from electric co-op. And I should have bid on it. And I still regret not like bidding higher. It would have been a great car for pretty cheap. I should have done it. And I just, I'm an idiot.
So Matt, could you share a little bit about your book, who it is for, what is it about, start at the end, how to build products that create change?
Yes, that is the book, Start at the End, How to Build Products That Create Change. It is for everyone that doesn't mind that it has cursing. I don't know. It is, you know, it is a somewhat irreverent book that's very much in my voice, but it's fun. I think it's for anybody that wants to change other people's behavior. You can get the audiobook on Audible, which they kindly let me read. So if you'd rather hear me, if you've listened to this interview and you like the sound of my voice and you'd like to hear me do all the cursing, then you can Audible and then it will be me.
Nice. Matt, would you like to share any online address where people can reach you?
I generally have a very public life, so it's very easy to get a hold of me. I'm matt@mattwaller.com. I'm Matt Waller on Twitter, right? Like, I have a link on every platform where you can get some office hours time with me, right? I devote 2 hours a day to people being able to get in contact with me, so you can book time for free. No, I think this has been a fun format. It's been super fun for us to get a chance to chat. And I think, you know, I think people often, it's interesting to me that in the world, there's like a whole set of people who love podcasts and a whole set of people who don't love podcasts. And we're missing that messy middle, right? Like there should be a messy middle of people who like some podcasts. And I think this is a perfect place for people who might not love every single podcast. You don't have to love the format that's podcasting to love a show like this, right? To learn something from a show that is talking about experiences, you know, at the edge of where things are.